Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And it's a very buggy show.
But well worth it.
And you know me, I love the bug thing somehow.
A little bug noise.
Okay. I love the bug thing.
I know you do. You're a bugologist.
I don't know why.
Your eyes bug out from time to time. They are fascinating creatures.
They are.
And not all bad. There are some that do us a lot of good.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And some don't.
Some don't. But, you know, there's a way to balance everything. Pretty much everything has a purpose. It's just that sometimes it gets in the way of what our purpose is.
Yeah, actually,
and there's got to be a balance there.
Man
somewhere.
Gets in the way.
Exactly. We're the pest.
They were around before we were.
Anyway.
Boy, if the old-fashioned dinosaurs had had human aside.
No kidding.
We wouldn't be here.
Be in big trouble. All right. Dave Shetlar today on the show. He is an entomologist out of Ohio State University in Columbus. The characters, these entomologists from some of these universities, right. I just adore.
What normal person would go into bugs?
I guess, but he's another cool one. He's Dave, the bug doctor Shetlar, and he's going to talk to us about pesticide research in terms of our alternatives, basically.
Exactly.
The biorational world of pesticides, you know, including botanical and biological, and then there's some other little specifics within that we'll learn about.
And if we're lucky, he might mention Neem.
He might.
We'll see.
I bet he will.
Okay.
I bet you some money on that one.
Okay.
All right. Western Kentucky Botanical Gardens in Owensboro.
Yeah, I gave a talk out there a couple months ago, and I was just really pleased and surprised at how well that thing has come along. I didn't know it existed, frankly, until they invited me out to talk.
Uh-huh.
And one of my pet peeves about Louisville, you know, Bernheim is a great resource. Udell is a great resource. I just think Louisville needs a botanic garden. They've tried over the years, and it just hasn't ever taken off.
Mm-hmm.
And here, Owensboro does have one. And
right.
It's a nice, you know, it's embryonic. You go there and you visit, and you can see where it's been and where it's going. But a man named Bill Tyler, who's a doctor there, who donated 8 acres to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk to him.
Yeah.
And then they've got this wonderful big bug show, these wooden constructs, 8, 10, 15 feet tall, of 10 different bugs that travels around the country. And they were lucky enough to get in line and get the thing in Owensboro. And I encourage anybody to go see it because it's just fun.
The artist is Dave Rogers. He's from, the Northeast. And,
you
know, what's so unique about this, I think, compared to other sort of bug art, is not necessarily its size, but it's all made out of wood because a lot of that other stuff is kind of forged metal stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's more organic than what we're often used to when it comes to colossal types of art. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So that's coming up today on the show. We hope that you'll stick with us. Bugs from all different sorts of perspectives, to be sure, and learn a little bit more about the Western Kentucky Botanical Gardens. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
It's another B word for me. I woke up about 2 weeks ago.
That's good.
Yeah, right. This will not amaze you. And the word beach balls came to mind.
Oh, Lord.
And I thought it'd be kind of fun to have 15 or 20 beach balls scattered around Hidden Hill.
Uh-huh. So not together, but just like you come upon a beach ball
and
scratch your head.
It's kinetic art.
Ah.
And I've got big beach balls and little balls and little foam rubber balls.
Uh-huh.
And there's 15 or 20 of them
out
there.
And you're allowed to kick them?
Anywhere they want. And I go out once a day and bring them back out of the bushes. Some people put them up in the trees now.
Okay.
They're catching on to the whole process.
Uh-huh.
But it's just kind of a neat thing to add summer and fall color to the garden. Here's these bright balls anywhere you want to kick them,
uh-huh,
kids. They only cost $1 to $4 if they want to steal some. It's fine.
Do they all look alike?
No.
Okay,
they're different colors, different sizes.
Cool.
It's just fun, and I'm sure I didn't invent this concept, but I'm going to claim it.
I don't know, but I think that's a good one.
Until somebody else. Yeah, because it's so easy, and people mention right away.
Kinetic art, movable art.
Yeah, and they're absolutely.
Engages the visitor in the whole process of things, I guess.
And it's easy.
Cool. And it's cheap.
That too, yeah.
Just takes a little hot air on your part, which I'm sure is really easy, especially since you're retired now. You got some extra hot air to blow out.
I could not believe it. I woke up Monday morning for the first time in 40 years, literally. I wasn't facing a job,
thing.
And I said, man, I love
Other
this.
Other than me. Not that I was in his bedroom by any means, but later in the day.
You're my penalty. You're the price I pay.
Well, I think that's a great idea.
The wish you stay. What's
up? I like
up?
The beach ball
Come
idea.
Come on, kick my balls, guys.
I need some beach balls in the vegetable garden because I'm having a green bean failure.
Oh, no.
This year because of the birds, I guess.
Well,
I can't. I have put nets over some of my haricot vert, like those really beautiful, small, tender green beans.
Right.
But somebody else is, and it's not bunny rabbits because it's, you know, deer can't get in the garden because there's an 8-foot fence around it. And it's not bunnies because it's not like a clean slanted right. cut. So the only thing I can think of is the birds, you know, because we've got crows.
I've got a confession to make.
Are you destroying my beans? So every time a bean starts to vine up,
yeah.
we're like, oh, yay. And then you go back the next day and somebody it's pecked gone. It off. So the the plants are actually, they're stunted because somebody keeps, you know, yeah. snipping them off. But they've got all these blooms on them, you know, all yeah. that. But they probably won't have enough energy to do anything because the foliage keeps getting...
Timing's everything.
So, but I'll have some because I've covered them finally and they're starting to come back on. But my pole beans are just, you know what, out of luck. Unless I figure out how to protect them somehow.
If you don't have beans, then I don't get beans.
Exactly.
This is a tragedy.
It is a tragedy. And, you know, I do think it's the birds. I don't. It's not like an insect or anything like that. So it's not like I can control
it. Happened before,
plus,
though.
I don't... Not in such a broad way. My Swedish brown beans that I got so that we would have homegrown Swedish brown beans for Christmas, which we make, you know, our Swedish smorgasbord. Huh. Same thing with them.
Well, God works in mysterious ways.
He does. So, yeah, I got to net them better or something. So I've got some going, but all in all, it looks like it's going to be a dud for me this year.
I'll loan you a beach ball or two to kick around in your misery.
I think, actually, that may help. A ball might kind of scare him a little bit.
Yeah.
I may employ that. All right, what's going on around town, Bob?
Well, actually, this is across the river, north of the Ohio. This is an annual event, and it's really a nice one. The Clark County Soil and Water Conservation District has this annual sale of some really interesting native plants and unusual plants and shrubs.
And trees.
And trees, absolutely. And they're 3 to 4 footers, 3 gallon size, nice plants. Most of them, the big ones are in $20 range and the perennials in $7 range. But it's good stuff.
It's very good stuff.
It's a
very
good cause.
Price.
The deadline is September 15th, 2008.
Yeah.
So if you want more information on how to get these plants with the Clark County Soil and Water Conservation District, visit our website at wfpl.org.
Yep, and there's a green gardening workshop out at UDEL Saturday, August 23rd. It's being sponsored by Boone Gardner, which is, you know, right close to them now.
Right next door.
But it's an all-day affair, 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. It includes lunch. There's a fee for members and non-members, of course. But they'll give you a really good lesson all day long on how to be a smart organic gardener at home. So check that out, of course, by going to UDEL or our website at wfpl.org.
And if by chance you see some bugs out there.
I mostly don't freak out about bugs. I don't even use that many, quote unquote, organic pesticides.
I know.
But I do have, of course, neem.
Neem.
And we'll find out what our other options are as well, because Dave, the bug Dr. Shetlar, is joining us. He's an entomologist at Ohio State University and OSU Extension Specialist, where he develops pesticide education information. He specializes in landscape entomology, and some of his current research projects include developing biological controls, biorational pesticides, and tools for timing and monitoring pesticide applications. Dave, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Listen, what have been, in terms of pesticide choices for the average gardener, what have been the basic ones that people are always reaching for, and particularly in light of the fact that I think some of those may be phased out by the EPA now?
Well, that's always been a concern recently because many of the newer insecticides, basically what EPA did is they have restricted. Everybody says they banned.
Okay.
But their term is restricted. Most of the organophosphate insecticides, those were things like Durzban and Diazinon, and basically eliminated those from household usage and from home landscape usage and home vegetable garden usage.
Okay.
Now, I guess the kind of bizarre thing that goes with that is that these are still available to be used in agricultural areas. So you get some rather strange things happening. Let's take Durzban. Durzban was the number one organophosphate insecticide used everywhere, both in agriculture and in the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Well, EPA considers golf courses to be a farming operation.
Oh.
So golf course superintendents can still use Durzban, yet you can't use it in your backyard, even though you might be living around a golf course.
Mm-hmm. So, Dave, what are some of the reasons for the restrictions in terms of so-called home use?
Well, and again, as a scientist, I sort of doubt the real reasons. The real reasons that everybody states is that they were trying to reduce long-term exposure of primarily youth. We do agree that children are probably at greater risk of having adverse effects from exposure to pesticides, but yet there's very little actual data out there that support that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm stating is that there's anecdotal information. There are certain children that are at higher risk. These are ones that have often neurological disorders or some other health problems that when they are exposed to some of these chemicals do exhibit adverse effects to them. But I kind of have to chuckle. Almost 10 years ago, there was somebody that actually said, well, you know, and this was from the chemical industry, well, if we have no data, why don't we put together a study where we expose kids to these pesticides and actually measure it? and of course,
oh boy.
EPA and the rest of people, you know, we don't really use human subjects that way.
Yeah, send your kid in, please.
So, alas, it remains anecdotal.
Yeah. So, in reality, we have anecdotal information. We do have some people that express concerns. And so I guess the bottom line is that if there are concerns and so forth, can we remove these or can we restrict them?
Mm-hmm.
And primarily since people and children would potentially be exposed to these around their home and around their gardens and yards, let's try to restrict those.
Well, Dave, yeah. Is the fear a cumulative effect? Because I was spraying the bad stuff for 20, 25, 30 years before I got more eco-friendly. Has the damage been done? Or again, is there no testing about that?
Well, if you really talk to toxicologists on this, there are basically two principles that need to be understood and are often ignored by people. And one of those principles is that the dose makes the poison. And if you're typically exposed to low amounts of something, it's probably not going to be dangerous to you. And that has always been the interesting thing, is that most insects are anywhere from 10 times to 100 times more susceptible to many of these insecticides than our human beings.
Right.
And so that's why we can use them at differential rates and kill the insects, but hopefully not kill us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you were talking about is also the long-term exposure. What would be the cumulative effect of
right.
these? And, of course, those data are always much more difficult to put together and evaluate. But it comes, again, down to another principle in toxicology, is that most chemicals your body detoxifies. And there are very few of these insecticides that are sequestered in your body forever.
Okay.
On the other hand, there were some. I mean, let's face it, DDT was accumulated in your fat tissues,
and
once it was accumulated there, you didn't metabolize it. It just sat there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dave, like, I'm having a little trouble this summer with Japanese beetles again. They're back,
mm-hmm.
and I somewhat guiltily use a broad-spectrum pesticide to get rid of these things.
Sure.
Is there a better weapon against the Japanese beetle than... Is there a selective one that will just get something like that?
Actually, if you're willing to use a botanical insecticide... there's a material called azadirachtin.
Okay.
Now, in the past, azadirachtin was sold under neem extract. The neem tree.
All right. Neem. Bob teases me because I always recommend neem.
Right. Well, the problem with using neem is that neem is often just a crude extract.
Okay.
And if the neem tree that year didn't produce very much protected chemicals, then there's not much in that extract. So when I tell people... I don't mind using azadirachtin or neem. Now, azadirachtins are the active ingredients in the neem seed.
All right.
Okay.
And so when you purchase a bottle of that, check on the bottle, and if it just says crude extract, leave it alone. Don't get it.
Okay.
But if it says contains azadirachtins at so-and-so percent, you know exactly what's in that bottle. Oh. That stuff will work for you if you follow the label directions.
Will it get most pests along with Japanese beetles?
It, it is quite repellent to Japanese beetles. Again, the problem with those is that since this is a botanical insecticide and is susceptible to degradation, you're probably going to have to apply it about every 10 to 14 days during the flight period of the Japanese beetles. But if you think about it, that's really no different than when we were using 7 or right. arboreal insecticide. You'd have to apply it about every 10 to 14 days.
Exactly.
Yep. So, Dave, some of your research centers around this botanical and biological control when it comes to pests in the garden. So let's sort of break down what biological botanical pesticides are and what's coming down the pike in terms of our options.
Okay. I guess let me first broach the topic of biological.
Sure.
To an entomologist or to a biologist, what this means is an actual disease, often something like a virus or a bacterium or a fungus, that actually infects the insect and kills it that way.
Okay.
And a lot of people go, man, I'm not sure I want to spread a virus or a bacteria out there, right. But these are very specific. These are specific biological agents that would only kill insects, and in many cases, only a very narrow spectrum of insects.
Okay.
Now, the other thing that I want to point out is what we call bio-based. And to give you an example, BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, this is a bacterium that produces a little protein toxin. And when you digest, if you're an insect, if you eat this, when you digest that bacterium, this protein is released. It's sort of like, I'll teach you to do that. If you eat me and digest me, I'll teach you not to do that.
Okay.
And so this protein is released. This little protein uncurls itself inside the insect gut and then pokes a hole through the gut lining of the insect. And since insect midgut is only one cell layer thick, then all the rest of the goo in the gut sort of seeps out into the insect, and the insect actually dies of secondary infection or septicemia. In other words, the Bacillus thuringiensis is killed by the insect digestion. And so that bacterium doesn't grow, doesn't proliferate, doesn't reproduce inside the insect.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we would call it a bio-based insecticide. We have another bio-based insecticide that is called spinosyns. Now, spinosyns, and these are available. I know Gardens Alive has a spinosyn material, but the original spinosyn materials was produced by Dow, and again, this comes from a soil-dwelling microbe that when you grow this microbe in a big fermentation chamber, it actually excretes a set of four chemicals, which we call the spinosyns, and these spinosyns have a neurotoxic effect on insects. So here is a, basically a soil-dwelling microbe that excretes an insecticide.
I almost feel sorry for the bugs. I never thought I'd say that.
Yeah, and what we do then is or what Dow does, is they ferment up hundreds of thousands of gallons of this microbe, and then they siphon off the microbe and take what's left and distill out the spinosyns. And it's a very powerful caterpillar killer, but it also kills quite a few other insects. And what's also unique about it is that it has miticidal activity, so it'll kill spider mites, too.
But no effect on your pets if you're...
Right. It is very low in toxicity to people and pets and so forth. And like I said, they're spinosyn because of the artificial inert ingredients. They have to put a detergent and a surfactant in it.
Okay.
It wouldn't be considered organic, but if you check with some of the other distributors... there is an organic form of spinosyns that uses natural surfactants, and thus the organic gardeners can use it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be darned.
So the botanicals then are like the azadirachtins that we get out of neem, because that's a botanical plant.
Right. The two botanicals that are probably most commonly used would be the azadirachtin and good old-fashioned pyrethrum.
Okay.
And the pyrethrum still comes from the pyrethrum chrysanthemum. still a good active insecticide for many insects. It's kind of a weak insecticide, and because of that, they often put in an artificial material, peperonial butoxide, as a synergist. And of course, that would take it off of the organic list once you put that peperonial butoxide into it.
Uh-huh. Okay, Dave, one more question. Is there any evidence that there is less of a chance for insects to become immune? You know how seven doesn't work on certain beetles anymore.
Right.
Is there less of a chance that insects will become immune to these natural approaches?
Sure. And we know that development of resistance is always related to, number one, the genome of the insect, the kind of insect.
Mm-hmm.
And to give an example, Colorado potato beetle is already resistant to the beetle active or leaf beetle active strain of BT.
Okay. And
the reason for that is when that beetle active strain was first discovered, all the potato growers said, hey, this is great and wonderful. And so every one of them used it on every acre of potatoes that they had. And the Colorado potato beetle basically said, I either am going to be exterminated,
right, or
I've got to adapt. And guess what it did? It adapted.
It adapted into the super-duper...
South Dakota,
right,
potato beetle.
And
yeah.
So that's what we see. Fortunately, most of these biological or bio-based materials are not used as extensively as many of the insecticides. So... Mm-hmm. We don't force the insects, but we do know if you do force them, if everybody used BT, then we would see some of the caterpillars probably developing resistance.
So the lesson in that is to use, no matter what you're using, selectively, sparingly, and responsibly.
Yep. Absolutely, and use it only when you need it.
Yeah,
when you know that you've got a pest problem, then you'd want to use it.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, you know way too much for your own good. You realize that, don't you?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Dave, the bug doctor, Shetlar, is an entomologist and extension specialist with Ohio State University. In addition to research and teaching, Dave also collects antique bug-catching devices, which include a fine Victorian-pressed glass fly trap with fly finial, and a May 12th, 1888 edition of Good Housekeeping that includes a remedy for deterring buffalo bugs, Bob. One Victorian housewife says,
I'm loving this guy.
Chopped onions with borax on breadcrumbs and put it under the carpet. Dr. Shetlar spoke to us from his office at OSU in Columbus, Ohio. For more information, of course, you can go to our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, big bug art and the botanical gardens of Western Kentucky. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Everybody's jumping, moving around. Nobody's standing still, keeping the ground. You can't tell what will happen when they pass it around. And it's a bug. Well, come on, baby, let's do the bug. Come on, baby, give me a hug. Come on, baby, my turn's long. Do I want a bug? Bug. A hole in my shoe, well, real bugs bug me, no matter what size. Spiders, mosquitoes, grasshoppers, and flies. But this kind of bug really takes surprise. It's that a bug.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Buggy Bob Hill.
Buggy Bob Hill. So do you trust me on the whole neem thing now?
Neem? Yes. Actually, I did all along.
Oh,
I was
you just like to make fun of me.
Well,
yeah.
It's a living. You know? Only because you're so hard to make fun of.
Well, no kidding. And I do. It's like sometimes feels stupid recommending it as like that's the only thing I know how to recommend. But if it works, it works.
I am up to now combining neem with seven, so I think I'm phasing my way out.
No, you have to totally get rid of seven.
I am, honestly.
You don't want, yeah, because we don't want it. Okay.
And it works.
Yeah.
My roses in particular are Japanese beetles, and now they're elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. All right, man. There we go. All right, on to bigger bug things and bigger plant things. There is a great big bug art show that's taking place that if you're into bugs, you may want to enjoy. But first, we're going to get the lowdown on the Western Kentucky Botanical Gardens in Owensboro.
Yeah, it's neat. I was there, maybe a couple months ago and visited the place. And was just very impressed with the spirit of the place and what they're trying to do.
Sounds
and the fact
great.
They have one, as opposed to Louisville, Kentucky, which doesn't.
Right.
And the entree to this thing was a man named Bill Tyler. He's been practicing internal medicine in Owensboro for 35 years. Became interested in gardening when he started a daylily garden in 1987. He later gave the 8 acres of land that would become the Western Kentucky Botanical Garden.
First step.
To the master gardeners there and to the community, and they've developed it ever since. And he's going to explain to us how he did it and what maybe we can do in Louisville to get more cranked up here to get a botanical garden going.
Great.
Well, Bill, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, the Western Kentucky Botanical Garden, great name, great place. It's got a real good future. Began in 1993. How did that happen?
Well, it started out as sort of the idea of a group of master gardeners here in Owensboro. They were interested in possibly forming some type of a garden for some of their own plantings and also for the community in general. And I got involved with them, and at that time we had a bed and breakfast and had some acreage associated with that. We were able to work out a program where we could give 8 acres to the Botanical Garden Association, and so it started from 8 acres of a soybean field, perfectly flat and perfectly sterile, actually. So
yeah.
It was a little hard getting things started and turning it back into a real garden, but we've had a lot of fun doing it.
So how do you go from a pretty sterile, literally and figuratively, soybean field into a garden? What kinds of plans had to be made to really get the ball rolling?
Well, we started out by developing a master plan as to exactly what we wanted in the garden and set up different areas for different theme type of gardens.
Mm-hmm.
The soil itself turned out to be fairly good soil, although we've tried to amend it every chance we can. So we've been doing that over the years, and actually we've produced some pretty nice gardens at the present time.
Where'd the funding come from? Certainly you didn't have to bankroll the whole thing, Dr. Tyler. Was there good community support in moving forward?
We've had just tremendous community support.
Mm-hmm.
We started out with sort of a different idea. Most of the time you come up with an idea, then you raise funds, and then you start out.
Mm-hmm.
We came up with the idea that we would start out, obviously very slowly because we had no money. It was mainly started by just people who wanted to get out and garden and getting out and working in it.
Okay.
Until we finally developed something that people started noticing and people started becoming members and contributing, so the money has come along, and that's been a real pleasure for us that we've had such wonderful support from the community.
How big is the membership now?
We have about 350 members.
And then who designed it, and what component parts did you create when you designed it? How do you go about that?
Actually, we started out with the idea of designing areas that could then be used by someone who had a specific interest. Like, for instance,
mm-hmm.
we had people who were very interested in herbs and a nice herb society, and that was actually our first garden. We plotted out an area where that could be developed, and then with the herb society and other members of the community, they started designing the specifics of that herb garden, and we've done sort of the same thing with a very nice rose garden. Then the process has just continued to develop.
Well, Bill, I'm sorry, what impressed me when I was there, there's an educational aspect to this you should talk about. There were some students there that day. Some were helping more than others, of course, being students, but they were out there learning about the bugs and the plants and actually some hands-on work.
Absolutely. We feel that education is sort of the to everything, and we're very interested in providing educational opportunities for young people along the lines of just learning about the gardening. So we take the idea that it is important for children to get out with nature and to work with it firsthand.
Well, Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Dr. Bill Tyler has been a prime mover in the Western Kentucky Botanical Garden in Owensboro. For more information on the garden or the Big Bug exhibit, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. And crawling right along, we're now going to talk with David Rogers, the big bug guy who created the 10 large insects out of natural wood now on exhibit at the Western Kentucky Botanical Gardens in Owensboro. They will be there for several months, and their sculptor, David Rogers, will be with us for the next 10 or 15 minutes. David, welcome to Homegrown.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I was reading your bio, and apparently you've always had this need to build things from wood since you were a little kid. Tell us something about that. Where'd that come from?
Well, I think one of the reasons was, besides, you know, being like a lot of kids, you know, I think kids, all kids have a natural creative impulse, and I never met a kid that didn't, if you put some finger paints or a crayon or something in front of them, that they're going to go right to it. And so for me, you know, that was true for me, but the older I got, the more I wanted to build, you know, things with my hands, and I started borrowing my dad's tools, and mm-hmm. he always wanted to know where his hammer was, and it was always out in the backyard somewhere in some patch of woods where I was working.
Have you always been interested in insects? Do you have an entomology background at all?
Well, I don't really have an entomology background, but I my theory is that after the family pet, the next group of animals we get to learn about are the insect world, and I think first time we ever get to see a praying mantis, it's a sort of remarkable experience. You know, it's right. they're large and their posture and how they swivel their head around. I mean, right. you know, I was just like most boys, you know, I was pretty fascinated by watching insects do what they do.
Mm-hmm. And you started out, I think, building furniture, what, up in the Northeast where you grew up, and then you, let's talk about that a little bit, then we'll lead into bugs.
Well, as I mentioned, I was, as a kid, you know, I was just a builder of things and, you know, tree houses and forts and go-karts and, you know, anything I could think of. And then later in my teens and early 20s, I actually apprenticed with a boat builder and a cabinet maker. And then I was introduced to somebody making, a friend of mine at the time, was just making traditional American rustic furniture out of willow saplings, you know, bentwood furniture. And I just took to it right away. It was a lot of appeal there for me. I thought there was a lot of room for imagination and creativity, and you know, you really could design things your own way. There weren't a lot of rules or format to it, so that was a big attraction for me. And then the fall of 1990 was when I kind of broke down some walls, and I ended up making my first big branch sculpture, which was you know, made out of found forest materials, but it resembled a dinosaur, you know, like a Stegosaurus, mm-hmm. we'd call it.
So, Dave, do you see inspiration in the wood before you actually do something with it? Or does your inspiration come from somewhere else? Do you know what I mean? Like, can you, you know, drive by and see a piece of driftwood or a fallen tree and go, oh my gosh, that screams praying mantis somehow? or does it come the other way around?
Well, I think that starting when I was even pretty young, I think I was starting to see shapes and things in the trees, and as you mentioned, driftwood, you know, found objects, you know, natural materials. I think I was seeing things in them that other people maybe weren't seeing. And then, you know, there's certain trees later on when I started working on the big bug sculptures, there were certain trees that lent themselves immediately toward, you know, I decided to make the dragonfly, the red cedar trees, you know, which are tend to be, you know, much fatter at the base of the tree, the trunk, and then they taper and get very narrow. And it just, for me, there was no other tree to use. It already looked like a dragonfly body.
Right.
Staying,
gotcha.
You know, in the forest. Yeah.
Well, Dave, was there a specific inspiration for your first big bug?
Well, the original I was approached by the Dallas Arboretum initially and they really were just interested in me doing some kind of installation or an exhibit for their garden, and they gave me, you know, complete, you know, free rein, uh-huh. as far as what that subject matter would be. But because it was a botanic garden, I was thinking about subject matter, and I by then I'd done four or five of these giant stick sculptures, you know, that were dinosaurs, and I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to make these little tiny creatures that we almost take for granted, and put them on this, you know, create them on this huge scale where there would be this change in perception, you know, of, huh. you know, scale. So that was the pitch, and they thought it was a good idea, and they came up with some of the initial the original funding to create the first group of sculptures. The original concept was in 1991, and then the first installation was 1994.
Okay.
So it took a bunch of years.
Sure.
And it by no means did it happen overnight.
Right. So what kind of research do you have to do? I mean, are you concerned with representing any particular insect as accurately as possible, or do you give yourself a little artistic freedom there?
Well, I think in the early years, and I think this is an experience that a lot of artists may go through about, you know, concerned about how people will interpret or how they view your work. Because after all, you know, if you have this artistic intention and you're going to create something, and you're going to put it out there for public consumption. I mean, it's like putting a piece of yourself out there on display. And when I first started working on the actual pieces themselves, I was very concerned about this. Well, how do you build a 20-foot ant? You know? I mean, what does a 20-foot ant look like?
Right, perspective.
And how do you make it look like that? And I started looking in books, you know, entomology books, and somewhere in a relatively short period of time, I realized that that's not really what I was going to be doing, because the stick dinosaurs that I made were, you know, they were four-legged beasts, but it was the scale that, I mean, people automatically associated them with being, they looked like dinosaurs to people. And whether or not I was trying to make them look like dinosaurs, I mean, I was thinking dinosaurs when I was building them. So that came out, and that was an important lesson early enough for me. And that was really the approach I ended up using on the big bugs, which was just to make try to be comfortable with doing my interpretation of, mm-hmm. you know, what does a 20-foot ant look like? Well, what does a praying mantis that stands 18 or, you know, 20 foot tall, what does that really look like? And what parts of that insect do I need to work on so I make sure that people can view it and immediately identify it with something they know in nature? And I find that the kids actually recognize them
better than the adults.
Some of the ones that, you know, a lot of parents look at the praying mantis and they'll say cricket, grasshopper, and then the kids, they, you know, they're correcting the parents. And when I hear that, I really feel like, you know, I know I nailed that piece. I know I got that one right.
So what are your 10 bugs? You talked about praying mantis, ladybugs, two beneficial insects. Are they all beneficials?
Well, you know, there was a big discussion over the years, in recent years, about this idea of IPM, you know, integrated pest management, and people were defining, you know, bugs into two categories, you know, good bugs and bad bugs. And then some smart person came along and said, well, there's really no such thing as a bad bug. I mean, right. There are more beneficial and then there are less beneficial bugs. And to see one as being a bad bug and then once we define something as bad, it also seduces us into the belief system that we could use whatever poison we want on them to wipe them out, and we don't realize that we're creating a bigger problem because they're part of the balance of nature, and we keep messing around with it. Well, we're the ones that are going to be, you know, we could be perceived as the pest, not the bug.
Now, are you making more bugs for future shows?
Yeah, I'm always thinking about that. I mean, I have some new ones that I'd like to add to this exhibit, and I'm also working on a separate group of sculptures specifically called the pollinators. I have some of them already built, which is a bee in a flower, a bee in a hive, a butterfly, and I'm going to add a hummingbird with a flower to that group of sculptures and start touring them separately from the big bug.
What's your largest big bug that you have right now on exhibit?
Well, the original subjects were the ants, the praying mantis, the dragonfly, and the spider in the web, and they're still the biggest of the big bugs.
Mm-hmm.
The ants are almost 25 feet overall.
Wow.
And then the praying mantis spans, well, the overall length is nearly 20 feet, and the spider web is 12 by 12 feet, and the dragonfly is 17 feet by 17 feet.
How long does it take to make one?
It's approximately a month to 3 months per piece.
Okay, and where's your next stop for the bugs?
Well, I just launched a show in Framingham, Mass. At the Garden in the Woods, and then we just opened up the show at the Western Kentucky Botanic Garden, Owensboro, beautiful Owensboro, Kentucky, and that was a real fun event. They really know how to put on a party and make somebody feel welcome.
Good.
And so that's those are the two exhibits that'll finish up this year's tour. And then next year, I have an exhibit in Iowa and one in Texas, San Antonio, and another one in Huntsville, Alabama.
Could you have imagined this when you started?
You know, if you even told me half of the story, I thought you were pulling my leg, sure. I mean, I didn't really start out to, you know, for it to be an exhibiting, a traveling exhibit or anything like that. It was a one-time show, and by its own virtue and a lot of hard work, it became what it is.
So how long has the collection been on the road?
The first exhibit was in 94, and so this is the 15th season.
Okay, so you had all of those bugs back in 1994.
Well, the very first year, I just had the four different subjects. So I had, you know, five ants and three dragonflies and one praying mantis and one spider and a web. And then the next year, I had two gardens interested in hosting the exhibit, so I built another set. And then starting in 1995 and then 96, I started adding new subjects every year. And then in the late 90s, I'd done the exhibit with the Epcot at Disney, the International Flower Show there. Mm-hmm. And that really was a great thing to be involved with and a great group of people. But the head of horticulture at the time, Katie Moss Warner, she was the one that really laid the gauntlet for me and said, well, you've done a good job, and we like the seven, but we want to, you know, 15 next year.
All right.
And now if you want to come back. And so she really challenged me, and it was good. It was a good exercise to be challenged by somebody in that position and want to do well, want to work with the kind of caliber people you find over there.
Well, Dave, thanks a lot. Enjoy talking to you.
Yeah, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
New York native David Rogers has been touring the country for 15 years with 10 very large bugs. For more information on David, the Owensboro exhibit, or the big bugs, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Buggy Bob here.
Buggy Bob.
Questions.
Here's a question from Liza Merritt.
Mm-hmm.
And she has been working on transforming a garden in her new house in Crescent Hill. And it's been 2 years. She now has established flower and shade gardens, and she's very pleased with the outcome. But she does have a challenge, and that's getting grass established in the backyard. She seeded in the yard this spring and was pleasantly surprised to see the lovely grass popping up. However, it was quickly killed by her two dogs. No fault, you know, of their own, of course, because they do have to relieve themselves. She does understand that primary fact, right? But she's wondering if we have any sort of suggestions in terms of how to get a good stand of grass growing despite, you know, the shade and the dog challenge. Any ideas, Bob?
No.
No. Our recommendation is to put pea gravel down and create some walking paths, that sort of thing.
You just can't have both. The dogs are going to tear up the grass, and I don't know of any. There are like monkey grasses, liriope. There are tougher plants you can put back there in the shade.
Mm-hmm.
But this classic green grass lawn and two rambunctious dogs.
I do know Tony and Shelley Nold in their garden, they pretty much eliminated all the grass in their garden, so they don't have a problem with grass not growing. But they trained their dog to kind of go back into a graveled little area to go potty back there when they weren't taking her out for a walk and stuff, right? She was really good about it, and she would do that. So, I mean, honestly, sounds like she's got shade. She also mentioned some dark green slimy spots that contain no grass. It sounds like moss, right?
Yeah.
So the soil's probably sort of acidic because moss likes acidity, doesn't it? So just kind of work with what you've got, honestly, and do some gravel and walkways and sitting areas.
And brick areas and benches and containers.
Just get rid of the grass.
Yeah.
Honestly. And another fact, too, if you did it in the spring, really starting new grass areas now is a better idea, ironically
than
enough.
In the spring.
Spring seeded lawns don't typically do as well, right?
You should just help her neighbor start their lawn.
Yeah, there you go.
And you look over the fence and have both, dogs and a fence.
Yeah, but she'll probably continue to shoot herself in the foot with the dogs.
Yeah.
So.
Question from Susan.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my azaleas are looking really anemic despite two rounds of miracid this year and what I thought was acid mulch, pine mark mulch, before. They also get quite a bit of sun. Could that affect the leaves? Could something else be going on? Thanks, Susan.
Okay, the miracid thing, my understanding, if your soil's not a certain pH,
right,
you can only change it by about 1 point. Miracid is a quick fix, right?
Yeah. Well, if yes and no, obviously.
It doesn't change the pH of the soil.
Right.
It just sort of provides
Yeah, and it's not a permanent
iron.
Thing. And it's, yeah, it's not, if it's bad soil to begin with,
right,
it's going to be real tough to grow azaleas.
Yeah, it's a
quick fix.
It
sort of sounds that way to me
initially.
It's just bad soil.
If they look really anemic, because they
and
if they get a lot of sun, that's going to be hard on them as well, right?
Right.
They like shadier locations, to be sure.
Yeah.
Also, one thing to consider, anemic, typically yellowing, is that chlorosis and iron deficiency.
Yes.
But if they look kind of grayish or the underside of the foliage is sort of speckled, it could also be the azalea lace bug, right?
Yeah, there's so many possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
If it's any encouragement to Susan, I killed the first 37 azaleas I planted.
Did you? Yeah.
It takes a while to get that culture down and understand what they need.
Because she's doing the right thing by using... pine, not necessarily pine bark mulch, but the pine needles, I think, might be better acidifier. But if the soil's alkaline,
You got a problem.
And they'll never do well.
Yeah.
Sorry.
If you have a question that can depress both Bob and Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, some of your Latin words are pretty deep. Once in a while, they're pretty wide.
They are pretty wide.
Yeah.
The Latin word of the week this week is lattice. Not, yes and no.
Yeah.
Not lattice like L-A-T-T-I-C-E.
Like the fence or something, yeah.
But I think that's pretty much the same thing. But lattice, L-A-T-U-S.
Yeah.
Latta, L-A-T-A, or latum. L-A-T-U-M.
I'm with you.
It's the Latin word of the week.
It means
broad or wide. So if you think about lattice work, kind of broad little pieces of wood, I wonder if that's
part of it. I was trying to think of another English usage of the word lattice and couldn't think of one.
Latitude?
Well, there's longitude, latitude.
Latitude.
Might be something there.
But this is lattice with a
right.
U, not an I, so probably not. Okay, L-A-T-U-S-U-M or A. Broad or wide. For example, Astragalus lentiginosus variety lattice.
The good old speckle pod milk vetch.
And this particular variety has a very broad, leaf, maybe?
Or vetch.
Yeah. Origerin lattice, the broad fleabane.
The good old fleabanes, they're everything.
They are everything.
Everything you ever wanted.
There are a lot of fleabanes. They go right up there with carex and Pinstamen, don't they?
Yeah.
Campylanurum, you think? Nurium?
Yeah.
Latum.
The bird wing fern.
Don't you want to see a bird wing fern?
I do.
I can see it in my mind's eye just by the
I'm going to find
Latin
one
name.
And grow one. By next year at this time, we'll have one.
Okay. Campylanurum. Neurum suggests to me like the nerves or the veins, right?
Right.
So probably very deeply veined or colorful. Latum, broad, and I bet you it looks like a bird wing. I bet it's gorgeous.
I'm going to find one.
Okay. Euphorbia extipulata variety lata.
The square seed spurge.
This particular variety that has square seeds.
I want to see a square seed. That'd be fun.
Broad. It's a broad-leafed spurge, basically.
Yep.
Electoria lata.
The witch's hair lichen.
How about that for a broad haired lichen.
This may be the weirdest assemblage of plants we've ever had in one show.
I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
So yes, if you see lattice, latum, or latta, something about that plant will be broad or wide. All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you'll join us again next week.
Homegrown is produced by the very unlattice Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.